This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Charles Lincoln. Charles, nice having you back on.
Always good to talk to you, Bob.
So we are going to be discussing the topics of vice and the law. And I think a good place to get started would be comparing two different cities. So you've been living in New Orleans for quite some time. You've been going there back and forth. And I was recently in Las Vegas. And those two cities have, they're very different in a lot of ways. New Orleans has a lot more history, but they're both kind of associated as cities of vice. And Charles, you're in New Orleans right now.
I am. Well, Robert, I mean, I basically love New Orleans and despise Las Vegas. I realize that a lot of people have exactly the same feelings reversed, that they love Las Vegas and kind of hate New Orleans. And people who feel that way basically are people who love everything clean and shiny and new, because Las Vegas tries to keep everything clean and shiny and new. And this is interesting to me because, the same vices of gambling, prostitution, heavy drinking are associated with both places, but New Orleans and Las Vegas, you know, really just fit in. I guess they fit into the American dream of the present time as places of escape, and they're just psychologically very different kinds of escape. But New Orleans has so much more than that. It has the depth of 300 years of history. Today, this is 2015. New Orleans celebrates its 300th year as a city in 2018. That's going to be the tricentennial of the founding of New Orleans. I guess, I don't know if Las Vegas is up to the ripe old age of 75 yet.
Like the oldest part of it is from the 1950s.
So that would mean it's about 65 years old. I wonder if there was anything there as early as 1940, which would be 75 years ago. I mean, there might not be
not
anything
really.
Standing.
And plus, I mean, they've also like torn down a lot of the original. A lot of the original stuff, they're constantly tearing stuff down and rebuilding. So it's kind of a disposable city in the sense that nothing is permanent.
But, I mean, did it basically come into existence because of Hoover Dam? Is that why it came into existence?
Yeah, so
and
Hoover
so you,
Dam,
you,
I think,
Hoover,
was built in the 30s.
Yeah. So it's just... Oh, I just looked it up online, and it says we're both wrong. May 15th, 1905, official date for the founding of Las Vegas. May 15th, 1905, 110 acres of land was set aside. So it's 110 years old. How do you like that? Over a century, and we didn't have any idea. But I guess that's because it caters so much to the concept of newness. According to this, it had its first high school in 1928. In 1920, the population was 2,304. The first theater was established there in 1912. And in about 1908, the population of Las Vegas was 800, while Clark County had a total population of 3,321. Anyhow, okay, interesting. And the first hotel was established there in 1906. It was called the Overland Hotel, later the Las Vegas Club, and the Hotel Nevada, later the Golden Gate, constructed at Fremont and Main Streets. Learn something new every day. Of course, Las Vegas is one of these cities that could not have existed as a city without the Hoover Dam. So it's certainly, you know, part of the problem of geoengineering that we're talking about, that human misuse of water resources is resulting in not only a perversion of the environment, but a perversion of the human spirit in places like Las Vegas.
I remember I was listening to an interview with the actress comedian Bette Midler, and she was being interviewed about Las Vegas, and she was talking about. She's a fan of the city, but she's saying, like, as an environmentalist, she considers it to be one of the biggest ecological disasters.
And it is. It really is. I mean, building cities in the desert requires a huge investment of water, which is, because of the evaporation, rapidly used up and has to be replenished constantly. I mean, this results in just a major misallocation of funds. I mean, okay, in New Orleans, you know, basically we're in an area that we've got water to waste, and that leads to a whole different kind of ecological imbalance. But I think that building a city where you've got water to waste is a much better earth-friendly program than building a city where basically the investment of water is really becomes so critical that it really threatens life. I mean, it threatens people's ability to live freely. I mean, the whole of Southern California and Southern Nevada and even Arizona now, those areas are being overpopulated in a way that I think is very dangerous, ecologically speaking.
Yeah, I know. I think Las Vegas, it had a big recession about 5 years ago, but for a long time it's been the fastest growing city in America. And New Orleans, which we're also talking about, is a city in decline population-wise. But, I mean, whatever you say about Las Vegas, it is in a very stunning natural location. I mean, you have two magnificent mountain ranges on both sides. It's set in a valley. And you have a big, the Hoover Dam. I mean, you can say it's an ecological disaster, but it's a really spectacular place to visit. It's really a masterpiece to engineering.
Oh, I remember when I was a kid and in grade school, we watched a movie about, you know, doing the impossible, and Hoover Dam was definitely one of the impossible feats of early 20th century engineering. It's just that sometimes I think our arrogance as humans that we can overcome any obstacle leads us to create, not exactly Frankenstein-like monsters, but that analogy is very real. I mean, the way Hoover Dam and the other dams on the Colorado River has breathed life into the desert, it's a very unnatural kind of life, and that is analogous, I think, to Frankenstein. And to me, the setting of Las Vegas, the setting of Phoenix, these cities in the desert, they're destroying the beauty. I mean, I remember the very first time I ever went to Arizona, sometime in the late 60s. Oddly enough, my grandparents were visiting fellow by the name of Goldwater over there. He had something to do with government. But Arizona was very beautiful, and it lost. And southern the desert is in part beautiful because of its austerity, and because of the sparseness of life there. And when you start having green lawns in Phoenix and Las Vegas and Bakersfield, green lawns that take up so much water that in Arizona, at least, it starts to change the average humidity of the entire valley where Phoenix and Tempe are located, and Scottsdale. And you think that humans, you know, not in some mysterious conspiratorial way, but just by stupidly, you know, insisting on pumping so much water into this part of Arizona, they're actually changing the environment. Never mind what they did to Los Angeles. I mean,
just driving to Las Vegas, and if you drive there at night for the desert, it's just all dark. And then the moment you hit Las Vegas, it's just, I mean, it's a spectacular sight to see it for the first time, to see all the lights lit up and the different colors. But it takes up a tremendous amount of electricity. But it's a spectacular sight. If you haven't seen it before, it's worth checking out.
Well, you know, Paris was the original city of lights. I saw Ninotchka, 1940 movie with Greta Garbo the other night, and Ninotchka, Greta Garbo was playing basically a Stalinist era Soviet agent coming to Paris for the first time, and she was overwhelmed with the amount of light and electricity that was used just for decoration in Paris. And I mean, yeah, civilization can be very, very attractive to view. I don't think that Las Vegas, you know, remotely compares with Paris in terms of beauty, but you know, artificial light can be nice.
I have a replica of Paris there, so basically they have a replica of pretty much every place in the world. They have a replica of the pyramids in Egypt, which I think might even be bigger than the original pyramid, with a beam of light shooting from the top. They have a replica of Paris. They have a replica of Caesar's Palace, which is based on ancient Rome. Let's see. Just about anything you can anything you can think of. So it's sort of
anything except, you know, it's interesting. They celebrate anything except churches and places of learning. You know,
well,
there
are a lot of mega churches in Las Vegas, but they don't have the history and charm of the churches in New Orleans. There's those sort of big mega churches that look like shopping malls.
Yes, and those are. They have some of those in Los Angeles too. Last year, during Advent season, I actually went to one of them in the San Fernando Valley, and I was just blown away at how totally politically complacent they are, and how they are designed to, just like Ellen was talking about the SBA. I don't know where in Northern California she was visiting the SBA, but just like that, these mega churches, they are designed to teach, if not almost coerce, conformity with governmental programs, and to institutionalize governmental philosophy. And of course, another one of the problem of Las Vegas and the current evolution of New Orleans is that these cities are used as part of the panem circensque, bread and circuses program of government to make sure that people do not think, that people avoid thought at all costs. I mean, part of the reason I love New Orleans is that there is enough history here that I feel like I'm constantly surrounded by the relics of the great past, and you know, not just the past abstractly, but you know,
there's a lot of history. There's some history in Vegas, like what's it called, like with the mob, like the mobsters, like Meyer Lansky and Bugsby Siegel.
Not among the highlights of Western civilization, in my view. There may be interesting history about, you know, the sort of seeds of corruption and collapse in America, but compared to the beauty that was mid 19th century New Orleans and the magnificence of the world that it represented and that was evolving here, I'd say that, you know, Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel were on the downside, actually.
Yeah, the history of degeneracy, I guess. Have you gotten
yes,
a chance to visit?
I have not spent a great deal of time in Las Vegas. I have to be honest with you. I've had a couple of cases that involved Las Vegas and, you know, mostly mortgage foreclosure cases, but one of them involved a transvestite transsexual who was involved in a civil rights case. It wasn't the kind of civil rights case you'd think of.
Or
though,
now
because
that's not. Now you're not. Now you have to say. I don't think that's the politically correct term anymore. But anyhow.
I've never even remotely worried about what's politically correct or not. But anyhow, this guy, he was a guy in some sense. I mean, okay, he was a guy, but he had a very big, rich beard and a very well developed set of breasts too. but his civil rights case basically ended up. I found I couldn't get involved. It made me ill because he wasn't there claiming that he was being discriminated against because he was a transvestite or transsexual. He needed defense because he was basically oppressing and sexually harassing other people, and I found I couldn't. I was actually incapable of defending him because I couldn't wrap my brain around any part of that being right. And that he rightly or wrongly, he sort of became emblematic of Las Vegas to me. That I guess the politically correct term is transgendered, which is just as natural in my books as what is overwatering the desert so that you can have lawns there, green lawns like in old England where it rains, you know, every other day. You know, these are disturbing things to me. What can I say? The perversion of nature, the perversion of social life, they all seem to go together, and they all seem to have something to do with, you know, the overdevelopment, the overuse of wasteful wealth through credit systems. And it all connects to me. And the interesting thing about New Orleans, of course, is that what created the beauty of New Orleans was an economy that was one of the most productive economies that the world has ever known, one of the richest, most productive quasi-industrial agricultural economies that ever existed on the face of the planet, and at least up until 1960.
Basically, Las Vegas' economy is based entirely on gambling and tourism.
And that's based entirely on credit. It's productive of nothing except entertaining people to make sure that they do not think. They have forgotten how to think. And, you know, of course, a lot of people stagger around New Orleans incapable of thinking because they've voluntarily rendered themselves that way. But, you know, that's that's part of the world we live in. People are so tortured by the reality they're forced to live with that they want to obliterate their minds, because even if the government weren't encouraging them to obliterate their minds, they want to avoid every possible contact with reality, because reality is just too painful and doesn't fit. Nothing quite works.
So basically, there. You don't. Do you have at least what? Do you have anything good to say about Las Vegas?
I'm gonna think here. I'm gonna think real hard. I promise. I mean, I could say it provides massive employment opportunities for, you know, otherwise unemployable corn bunnies and, you know, farm girls who have no other career other than, you know, going into certain professions that might be better protected from governmental regulation in Las Vegas. But such opportunities actually exist pretty much nationwide these days. No, I really can't think of anything unambiguously good about Las Vegas. I mean, even your comment about the landscape and the setting, just it makes me sad, because it would be so much nicer if there were no city there.
I mean, it really is a spectacular, I mean, landscape. I mean, there's a mountain there called Mount Charleston, and it's really, I mean, it's, in some ways, it's more spectacular than the Sierras, because it's more dramatic, because from the Sierras, you can't really get a good view from the Central Valley. The Central Valley, the air is so filthy, but just it's so crisp and clear, and especially if you go in there in the winter, the mountains there are covered in snow.
Let's see, why exactly is the air so filthy? Oh, that's right. It's because they took all the water out of it and it's become a dust bowl.
And I was always going to comment on old Las Vegas. So it is. So I don't. You haven't been there, but it is at night. There are a lot of at night. It's a cool place to visit at night, because there's a lot of there's a lot of beautiful sort of vintage signage from the 1950s and 60s. But I'm sure you have that in New Orleans too. But basically, if you
got that,
down
you got
the
that in New York City, for that matter.
If you basically took down all the signage in Old Vegas, it would basically look like Fresno.
And Fresno, as we know, is a very beautiful place.
Yeah. Well, what were you saying about New York City?
I'm saying that you've got a lot of beautiful old signage and Art Deco and interesting things in New York City, Manhattan also. I mean, probably even more than either Vegas or New Orleans.
The thing is, in New York, Times Square, they took down all the older stuff, and it's just all this new sort of bland
that's
corporate
Times Square. But I'm talking about on the upper East Side, Greenwich Village. I mean, once you get away from the major, you know, the major media centers, there's still a lot of old stuff there. I mean, I had the opportunity to spend almost a month in New York last year, and if it weren't so expensive that, you know, no normal human being can live there, it would be a great place. I would choose Manhattan over Las Vegas for a vacation anytime. Even though Las Vegas is very cheap, and I mean, I guess that's the big thing about Las Vegas, is it's cheap, right? So then, you know, it's a cheap vacation, cheap change of scenery for people. Even cheaper these days than New Orleans. But basically, they do have parallel symbolism as the centers of American degeneracy. And I guess, you know, right now, ever since Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans has sort of been gentrifying. It's kind of interesting. They got rid of about after Hurricane Katrina, they flooded about a quarter to a third of the black population, and so the population is almost equal right now, roughly 50% white, 50% black. Whereas before,
remember the mayor, New Orleans mayor Ray Nagin said, when we rebuild the city, it's going to be a chocolate city.
Well, he was wrong. A lot of Hollywood money came in here. Sandra Bullock and Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt have invested tremendous quantities of money buying up real estate around here. It's almost like, you know, they were given, like, they had Hurricane Katrina made specially for them so that they could buy up all this real estate really cheap and, you know, be turning it around. And, you know, that has one strange effect is that they're preserving the outside of a lot of houses, and so it has the same appearance, but the inside of a lot of houses is being gutted, and so the real old historical character of a lot of homes here in the Garden District where I am right now, New Orleans 70130, is being radically changed, and...
And
the
way
past 10
those
years.
Basically, with the historic preservation laws, they're usually about the exterior. It's very hard to legislate what people do to the interior of their house.
Well, they try awfully hard. I mean, they tell people that they need to use original materials and, you know, things like that. But I know a lot of people who are involved in this, and one of the tragic things is that there's one species of cypress that is absolutely impervious to both fungus and termite rot. And that species has gone completely extinct because it was used in so many houses. And they wherever they find it, it's very precious. But they can't replace it. I've talked to people over at Tulane about, you know, whether they could, you know, clone it, you know, from DNA in the wood and, you know, sort of Jurassic Park-like, bring it back to life or something. But apparently they haven't been able to do that. And it takes a long time to grow a tree big enough to produce the kind of wood they need anyhow. So that aspect of it is very interesting. The historic preservation versus development. You can kind of tell that in the early years after World War II, there was very little preservationist mentality around here. They tore down a tremendous number of lovely old homes along St. Charles Avenue and even some of the side streets to build really ugly, sort of pseudo Bauhaus type apartments. But even so, I'd say that even St. Charles preserves about 50% 19th century construction, and on either side of St. Charles it's probably more than that, more like 60 to 75% 19th century construction has been preserved.
So Las Vegas and New Orleans, in a sense, they sort of played a similar role in a sense, like
they do play a similar role. I mean, you've got the same casinos, you've got Harrah's casino in both places. You've got a tremendous culture of, you know, basically appealing to lower middle class degeneracy, basically, to people who want to get wasted and gamble and, you know, it fascinates me in the French Quarter that people come to this amazing city, they get wasted, and they think they had such a wonderful time that they can't remember anything they did. This sort of boggles the mind. It's one of the I guess one interesting thought is that, you know, last summer in Beverly Hills, I told you about Barry Taylor's series, Sex, Drugs, Art and Religion at All Saints.
Yeah,
and
I didn't get a chance
Barry
to listen to it, but you told me about it.
Well, it's still online, I believe. You can listen to it. It's just fantastic because basically he was talking about how, you know, people need these escapes. The human mind is so complex, it can't really handle everything that the world gives it. It can absorb so many more facts than it can process rationally. And so basically people seek ways of polluting their minds so that they can avoid reality. And coming to a place like New Orleans or Las Vegas, where, you know, the Las Vegas advertising commercial, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in New Orleans stays in New Orleans, in large part because people can't remember what happened. So it, you know, it definitely stays here.
Does New Orleans,
hello?
Is a lot more kind of a free place because if you go in Las Vegas, newer part especially, everything is very controlled. There's just security everywhere, surveillance everywhere. It's
low,
a very kind
low,
of controlled environment.
Minimum security penitentiary.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the West for you. I mean, that's the culture of California creeping out across the Nevada border, I guess. Yeah, I mean, New Orleans is nothing like that. I think that New Orleans is much more, it's still very Southern. It's still very laissez-faire. It's still very pro-gun rights. The U.S. attorney here has announced his great goal is to disarm the city, but from what I can tell, he's not succeeding. People think it's very important in Louisiana to be armed and to keep control of their own lives. But that's not the tourist culture. The tourist culture is some kind of escape valve for the rest of society. And, you know, every day on the St. Charles streetcar, you know, it's crowded with tourists who are, you know, some in varying states of, you know, intoxication or hangover. And if they take the trolley, of course, they've gotten out of the French Quarter, and so they've got some interest in some of the history of the place. But yeah, the sense of freedom here is much different from the sense of Las Vegas. I mean,
well, in Las Vegas, there's basically two parts. There's a new part and an old part. And the new part is a very controlled environment. Then in Old Vegas, it caters more to like a lower middle class, working class crowd. And there, in that part, there's more. You see more people like drinking beers in public, like the kind of. I guess it's closer to New Orleans. I mean, I've actually heard people make the comparison between that part of Vegas and Bourbon Street.
Could be. I mean, I have to say, I find, you know, the famous several blocks of Bourbon Street totally repulsive. You know, constant drinking and, you know, really sort of gross displays of commercial sex. They've got a hustler club. What's the name of the owner of Hustler?
Larry Flint, yeah.
Larry Flint. There's a Larry. Larry Flint has a barely legal a bar called Barely Legal down there.
Have you been there?
Well, yeah, I've been there, but I don't particularly like it. I mean, it's part of the local phenomenon. I mean, what's much more interesting about the city is just for the people who live here, you know, that it's not, no one feels under an obligation to be either particularly moral or particularly immoral. People very much feel like they have a complete right to do whatever they want to do. The people who come for a weekend or a few days on Bourbon Street, they have such a compulsion to just be drunk the whole time and be wasted and have that experience, and that's sort of completely alien to me. But the interesting thing is that, I mean, you said you wanted to talk about the law and vice, and the interesting thing, of course, is that without the law, so to speak, there would be no vice. If there was no set of standards of what was right and wrong set by one group of people for another, there would be no need for sort of the police mentality of, what people, who can smoke, who can drink, who can't. And that's sort of the spirit of New Orleans, is that everybody drinks. Everybody who wants to does, anyhow. Everybody who wants to can do pretty much whatever they do want to. And nowhere else in the United States do you get that feeling, I don't think. I don't think that, Los Angeles certainly has a substantial drug culture and a substantial, commercial sex culture. But heavily regulated and heavily controlled, and so the hypocrisy is just gigantic.
LA is, on one hand, it's basically the center of the porn industry, but it's also a very very controlled and unfree place at the same time.
Well, I mean, isn't it interesting that it is the center of the porn industry and at the same time the center of, really, after New York, I guess, the most intense feminist reaction against male control, right? I mean, I don't quite understand how those cultures manage to coexist in the same county to the degree that they do. But you know, if you looked only at Hollywood and I guess certain parts of the Valley, you know, you'd think that all the city ever thought about was sex, and specifically commercial sex. But then in Westwood and Beverly Hills and Santa Monica, you know, you have the liberal, rigid, democratic culture of feminism, which rejects or seems to reject all of that. I think that California is a very interesting study in contradictions that way. In Las Vegas, of course, it's almost like the feminist side does not seem to exist at all, and all you've got is the commercial gambling and the sex culture, which is nonetheless not just regulated, but actually protected by the law.
So a place like Los Angeles, like places like the west side of L.A., Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, like those places are degenerate, but people still like want to put on an air of respectability. But I'd say places like Las Vegas, and I'm assuming New Orleans, are a lot more honest and open about their degeneracy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe one of the big differences about New Orleans is that New Orleans does have a complete society that is, that does have very deep roots. The way I was explaining it the other day to somebody was, the big difference in New Orleans is that the people who live here, anyhow, the culture of Mardi Gras, it's the culture that creates Mardi Gras, not the culture of people come to visit Mardi Gras, not the, that, but the culture of people who live in New Orleans and who enjoy the city is a culture of people who enjoy life because they accept death. And, you know, that's part of the cemetery culture and the mysticism of this city that I think is completely lacking in Las Vegas, is that in Las Vegas, it's just the temporary rush, the temporary escape, and there's no long-term perspective on anything. But
I heard Las Vegas has the highest suicide rate in the nation.
That's interesting. I mean, that of course means that people can't handle life, and part of the inability to handle life, I think, has everything to do with inability to accept death. Another one of the fascinating complexities of New Orleans is the degree to which churches and cemeteries and ritual are embedded in the life of this city. You know, there are cemeteries every few blocks, but even more common than cemeteries are churches. There's a reason why the football team here is called the Saints. Do you happen to know what that is?
Because New Orleans has that tradition with religion.
Well, specifically because every other street is named after a saint, and because it has more per capita churches than any other city in the United States. You know, you would think that Boston and New York have a lot of churches. They do, but there the population is so much greater. Here, the number of churches per person is higher than anywhere else, any other city in the United States. And the feeling is that really it's important to celebrate and enjoy life because it's so short. And the history here is so much with us every single day. You know, the old houses, the old churches, the fact that anybody who digs around is going to find old foundations and the old coins or old wood, even the old old cypress knees or something. It is just because, you know, one strength, the water table here is very high, and while if things dry out and get wet, that will have a very destructive effect on anything. But if things just stay submerged in water, they preserve pretty well. And so you've got a lot of a lot of preservation here because the water table is so high, and so the past really does stay with people. And, you know, everybody kind of accepts that and enjoys it. And the appreciation of how short life is really very un-American. The American ideal seems to be you live forever, and then you just suddenly disappear, either into a nursing home.
As Americans have this idea of like eternal youth, like they don't accept that they're going to get old.
Well, yeah, no, that's very much the same thing. I mean, once you're no longer, young and beautiful, you basically either go into an old folks' home or die, you disappear. Everybody is supposed to stay, youthful and undaunted by the not natural, the circle of life. And in New Orleans, again, you don't have that, you don't have that same cult of youth. One of the reasons I feel so much more comfortable in New Orleans than anywhere else is basically you're not constantly judged by whether even as a man, I am not constantly judged by whether or not I have, Brad Pitt's, face or muscles, Arnold Schwarzenegger's. And, it's a terrible burden to have to carry to be constantly compared to movie stars in Los Angeles. And in Louisiana, nobody has to do that.
Like, I kind of like picture you as being one of those guys like in an old school white suit, like running like a riverboat casino.
Well, except that I don't gamble. I guess running a casino, I guess, is no gamble at all, because you know you're going to make money regardless. So that wouldn't be a bad business. If I were ever to do anything illicit, it would probably be I'd be much more likely to run a whorehouse than a gambling institution, but
so,
not just me.
Basically, on those topics, like we talked about issues of vice, like the gambling. Let's see, there's gambling, there's prostitution, statutory rape laws. You basically think all that stuff should be legalized, your laissez-faire.
Well, de facto, it goes on whether we legalize it or not. I despise hypocrisy. I despise hypocrisy in the law. I despise social hypocrisy. I don't like gambling. It does nothing for me. And I don't like drugs. But, it doesn't bother me that other people enjoy it. I mean, in some ways, I think that gambling is just about the most tragic thing that can happen to people if they're hooked on gambling and can't stop, because this totally money driven desire to get rich quick, it's essential to capitalism, but gambling is sort of the extreme opposite of the Protestant ethic, which created capitalism. As far as prostitution goes, I think it's, I don't know. I mean, as I said, I'm really not a great fan of the hustler culture and sort of the intense, flesh marketing that goes on parts of Bourbon Street. But by contrast, I think it's sort of charming that they estimated that one third of the barrels at Tulane University, my alma mater, one third of the undergraduate girls at one point had registered on various different sugar daddy sites.
Don't you wish you still had all your money now?
We will not comment on that. We will not comment on that. New Orleans is one nice thing about New Orleans is you can you can feel okay about yourself here, even if you're not rich. Even if you're not rich, they in LA they say you can never be too rich or too thin, and that pressure just doesn't exist here. Makes it much more pleasant place to live. But you know, the relaxed attitude towards vice means that vice is not so vicious. Vice is not, where vice is not suppressed, it is not so evil. Now, well, going back to the last talk we had about a girl who walks home alone at night, that movie showed basically the drug culture and the culture of prostitution as extremely vicious and oppressive, because I guess in part because it was so completely prohibited, and you know, the people who take advantage of what is prohibited to make a living by providing that which is prohibited, they are the nastiest criminals, really, because you know, they know that the demand for things that are suppressed is never going to go away, and so they can charge and extort outrageous amounts of money from the people who are hooked on whatever it is that is prohibited. And that's sort of the culture that I see in Las Vegas, is that, you know, the middle American culture from, you know, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, the Midwest, they have such, traditionally at least they had, I guess it's all past tense now, but they used to have such strong standards of morality that it just totally crushed the people and made them crave the release of, you know, places like Las Vegas and New Orleans. But the difference is that New Orleans has this rather Latin American type of culture where everything is tolerated, and so nothing is prohibited fiercely, vice never gets nearly so evil. And I think that that's an important point. The greater degree of civilization, you know, the greater degree of sort of a relaxed degeneration. And that's what makes New Orleans special, is the relaxedness, the relaxation of degeneracy, and the fact that it doesn't have to be, except for the tourists who just come here for a few days, with regard to the local culture, it doesn't have to be quite so intense in short doses. And so the police here are much nicer than either Los Angeles or Las Vegas, or even places
or
like
even,
Dallas.
What about places like Lago Vista?
Well, Lago Vista is a suburb of Austin, and that's basically the same culture as Dallas and everywhere in Texas. Texas is very much a repressive police state, and Louisiana is fundamentally not. California is a repressive police state. Texas is a repressive police state. California seems to revel in and enjoy the degree to which it's a police state. Texas pretends not to be, but it is. There's sort of a legend in Texas that it's still
All those like Tea Party people are always going on about how Texas is this great paradise.
Yeah, and it's really not, but you know, it just doesn't celebrate its repressive nature to the same degree that Los Angeles in particular does. And I think that's really the interesting thing about the message of New Orleans culture is it's the golden mean in so many ways. Is it's not too repressed, except for those few blocks on Bourbon Street. It's not too you know, coercively debauched either. And it's like Las Vegas is, and even Los Angeles up to a point, the Hollywood culture in Los Angeles is it's important to be radically debauched, radically degenerate, and you just don't have that kind of pressure here. You don't have that kind of pressure at all, and I think that you know, that's why there's the feeling of freedom here. And I relate it all to the persistence of a spiritual tradition in New Orleans, even to the degree that things like voodoo are still important in certain sectors. As long as people maintain spirituality, they're in touch with the other world and the afterlife. And that means that they're not in denial about, you know, the fragility of this life. And I think that there's just an important philosophical point there that, you know, the way to live a good life is actually to be at peace with death, and to be at peace with you know, what the nature of our needs are, the nature of our needs for good food and you know, good relationships, so to speak. And that is I think what New Orleans seems to have the best perspective on.
Would you say that culture exists more in Europe and South America than it does in the United States?
Exactly, and New Orleans is one of the places that really preserves it in this country, and it's part of what makes the city very special. But yes, it's much more like part of Europe. I mean, I think that's why so many Europeans come here. You know, I'm at a hotel right now that has primarily English people staying here, a few Germans, you know, they definitely enjoy the relaxed transition compared to even their world back home, because of course England is the quintessential police state these days.
Well, yeah, it's interesting if you look at Europe. It's kind of interesting because England's also a traditionally Protestant country, like the United States, and England's definitely a total police state. But if you look at a lot of the Catholic countries in Europe, I mean, Portugal has, like, total legalization of drugs. Most of the countries like Germany, a lot of them, they have legalized prostitution. Most of those countries have a much lower ages of consent, and those are all Catholic countries.
Spain, and I believe it's Spain that has the lowest age of consent in Western Europe right now. Chile has an exception in South America. Has also, I think, Spain and Chile both have 14, I believe, as the lowest age of consent.
Why do you think people get so outraged by that topic? People get very uncomfortable with that topic.
Well, it goes back to the basic origin of law in general. The Old Testament is a fairly brilliant legal code because it focuses on the things that people do every day and makes it possible for, you know, one group of people to pass judgment on another group of people for that which is most natural. I think that part of the problem with age of consent and, you know, underage sex in general is that basically 13 to 21 are a girl's most fertile, perfectly physically fit for childbirth years, and you know, because people live so long right now, I mean, I think that one thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, prevent overpopulation on one level by keeping young girls from being as fecund.
What age do you consider to be the absolute peak of beauty?
It's not just me. I mean, I think it's in terms of myth and legend, I mean, sweet 16, 15. 15 is considered the coming out age in all over Latin America. 16, sweet 16. Quinceañeras in the Spanish culture, sweet 16 parties in English, in the English language cultures. That's the top flower of womanhood. And, you know, the interesting thing is it is demonstrable that if women bring children, women who bring children to birth before the age of 18 are basically immune from breast cancer. Now, why do you suppose that is? It's basically because the human body, like the body of any animal evolved to reproduce as soon as possible after the onset of fertility. And so the body structures that are used for fertility, if used in the early and mid teens, they're perfected. They're perfectly protected from cervical and breast cancer, and this is, I think it's just it's very threatening to people to allow nature to take its course.
If you look at artwork, a lot of classical statues and paintings from, say, the Renaissance era, I mean, they're nudes, but a lot of the girls in those like Renaissance paintings look very young.
Well, of course. I mean, they are the ideals of beauty, aren't they? I mean, angels.
But today, I mean,
you know,
today you couldn't. Today, that would be child pornography.
Well, again, I mean, I think that the problem is that our society has just developed these conflicting values of wanting to prevent children, or people that we classify as children, from realizing their full biological potential. Part of that may have to do with a genuine desire to keep population down. Another part of it may have to do with, you know, frankly, wanting to keep the white population down, because blacks and Hispanics are much more accepting of teenage pregnancy and it's much, you know, it's much more normal and common in their societies, and in particular, that's why Hispanic culture is just, you know, exploding all over the world, is because they are perfectly comfortable with teenage girls having several children by the time they're 20. And so their population is growing radically, and, you know, the white population is shrinking. And I think that this is a long way from what we were talking about in New Orleans, but, oh, I guess it's not, because the black population of New Orleans is still, you know, most black girls in New Orleans and most Hispanic girls everywhere are pregnant, have at least one child before they turn 18 or 20. And that's part of their demographic success and part of their demographic dominance. And, you know, the values of the white middle-class society are just terribly confused. What do people really want?
So we're basically out of time. We've covered a lot of topics. We started off with, let's see, New Orleans, Las Vegas, and then we got to this. So, yeah, it's been a great show.
Well, enjoyed talking to you. And
well, thanks, Charles.
Okay.
That is all we have for
great.
Today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Great talking to you, Robert. You have a good evening.